Oh my God, they got Alan Dershowitz telling us what to do about ISIS on the TV right now. You know, yeah, that's a sad thing. You know, years ago, Angela Keaton taught me the difference. Oh, hi, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And not the difference. Obviously, I know the difference. She taught me the sames of the neocons and the libertarians and how they're actually kind of cousins. Almost all of their founders were like upper middle class Catholics and Jews who were excluded from the old WASP establishment and had their own ideas about how things should be. And the neocons, in their case, made all their think tanks and created their own establishment and went and gained major influence in Washington, D.C., whereas the libertarians just kind of went their own way. And, yeah, you can tell I forgot what the hell I was talking about. The neocons and the libertarians. What the hell was I going to say about the neocons and libertarians? Jesus Christ, Scott Horton, nice way to start the show. Well, my show sucks. Welcome to it. I know something else I wanted to say. Was this supposed to segue to that somehow? No, definitely not. I had no idea what I meant to say about the neocons and the libertarians there. Jesus Christ. More coffee. Brian Hagan and Daryl Perry, they do the top of the hour news. And I don't think that it plays for every top of the hour on LRN. Maybe it does. But it plays always for the top of the hour news right before my show and then the middle break, top of the hour break too. And I have to say, this is how I'm making up for my complete and horrible brain fart at the beginning of the goddamn show. I have to say about these guys that they do the best top-of-the-hour news in world history. Sometimes it's 3 days late because they did it on Friday and I'm playing it on Monday or whatever. I don't care. It's great. It's the best damn top-of-the-hour news ever. And here's what I hate. Top-of-the-hour news. It's either Fox or it's something worse, right? Fox, all AM radio format, top of the hour news is just a nightmare. And except there's the Liberty Beat. And I'm not sure, is the Liberty Beat, I think is just Brian and then Daryl, his thing is called something else. Is that right? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Best top of the hour news I've ever heard. Best top-of-the-hour news I've ever heard in my entire life, and it's on my show. It's the top-of-the-hour news for my show. And I'm just so grateful for that. I really am, and I never mention it because I'm an idiot or something. I have mentioned it a few times, but I should mention it all the time. Just how great that is. And thank you to you guys for doing such great top-of-the-hour news and letting it play on LRN at the top of the hour during my show. You make it bearable for everyone to sit through the top of the hour break and not go away. Well, certainly for me. What was I going to say about the neocons and the libertarians? The libertarians obviously decided they didn't want power, and they all went and made their own think tanks in Alabama and San Francisco, far from D.C., and then that wasn't what I was going to say. I'm just trying to complete that sort of kind of line of thinking and hoping that the idea pops back into my freaking stupid brain. My stupid brain where the thought was a minute ago. My synapse took a left turn at Albuquerque, man. I need it to fire over there to the right, and it's firing the wrong way. The cops put up a roadblock on my corpus callosum. And so my hippocampus is, failing. What was I going to say? Neocons. Libertarians. Neocons suck. Libertarians are great. How about that? There's my awesome thing that I was going to say to start the show today. I have no idea what it was. What was I looking at? What window was open? That wasn't it. Here's the libertarians saying legalize heroin. There's proof that the libertarians are the good guys right there. That's not what I was thinking of, though. What was I thinking of? Goddamn. Yes, okay. I admit that this is the worst produced show in the whole world. All right. But at least I show up every day. I don't take vacations or anything. Sometimes I have to go to the dentist or something, but otherwise I'm here, man. And I'm right about everything when I can remember what the hell I want to say. And I have an impeccable taste in guests. And that really helps fill in the gap there. Yeah, we know, Scott. We hate you. We just tune in because we know you're going to have Gareth Porter on. I know. It's okay. That's why I have him on. So that you'll have him to listen to. Not today, though. Tom Harrington's going to be on the show today. And Grant Smith is going to be on the show today. And my growling stomach is going to be on the show today. I have invites out to Dar, to Patrick, to a guy from the Rand Corporation who wrote an interesting thing. I don't know. Didn't seem like he was lying or anything. I know that Rand is a think tank sponsored by the Pentagon. So, anyway. Sometimes they're good on the MEK. You know. You just gotta... Be careful. And then Bandow already told me, busy. Boy, that Bandow gets work done. What is up with that guy? Every time I try to get a hold of him, sorry, I'm traveling around the world. Sorry, I'm giving a speech in front of a university. Sorry, I'm doing this, that, or the other thing for 20 out of 24 hours today. I don't know how he does it. That guy's amazing. And his essays are really great. You know what I really like about Doug Bandow? Is he ain't just really libertarian. He's not an anarchist or anything, and occasionally strays and recommends that government do something, very lowercase s, something, in very restricted circumstances. So it's not his perfect libertarianism. It's that he actually really studies the stuff. He really knows what he's talking about, and he brings that great libertarian non-interventionist spin to it. Spin, whatever. Principle to it. But anyone can ask him. One may ask Bandow about just about anything, and he can give you a real answer, a real in-depth kind of thoughtful take on stuff. So, really like Bandow. Anyway, see if I can get him on later in the week. The neocons and the libertarians. Well, I don't know. I have no idea. I had no idea. What is it going to be? Well, neocons and libertarians. This may be the worst segment of radio I've actually ever put out in my life. Tom Harrington's coming on. Tom Harrington is now sponsoring this show. If he's listening now, he may be thinking better of it. Hopefully he's not. But Tom Harrington wrote a book called Living La Vida Baroka. And it's a collection of great essays, mostly concerning the empire. You will hear ads for it playing during this show, and I hope you'll like them. And it's a great book, and I really hope you'll check it out. If you go to skullhorn.org/books, you can buy it. And I have another new sponsor who I don't know if the ad is going to be playing today yet or not. I guess I'll wait until it does and talk about it then. But yeah, Tom Harrington's going to be on the show, and I don't know how much. I think I'm going to have him on to talk about a lot of different stuff because he's covered a whole lot of stuff. He writes for antiwar.com from time to time, and he the book is a collection of, I don't know, 30 essays or something. They're really good, man. You should read it. And so I'm going to want to talk to him a few times, I think. Because you know how it is, 2 10-minute segments, you can only get so much covered. And I think today I really want to talk about what's going on in Spain right now. Because I hardly know a thing about Spain other than all street skaters love to go to Barcelona, you know? Other than that. So I'm going to have Harrington on. We're going to talk all about Catalonia and Basque and all the separatism and the American Empire and great stuff. And then Grant Smith, of course, on the Israel lobby, the lawless Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. Back in a sec. Neocons and libertarians. Yeah, it's gone. That thought ain't coming back, I don't think. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, I'm Scott. I'm sorry. I'm such an idiot. As soon as I went out to break, I looked up at the chat room, and the guy says, Dershowitz! And I says, oh yeah, Dershowitz! Well, they went to commercial or something, and I was almost done. All I was going to say was, the libertarians and the neocons all were kind of knew each other, and they all hated welfare and liberals together, and they hated the WASP, you know, Northeastern establishment together, and yet the libertarians all went to Alabama and San Francisco, and the neocons all went to D.C., and the neocons, no matter how many times they've gotten everything wrong for generations now, they always have something to recommend, usually something drastic, usually something that can make a politician feel great if he does it. I'm going to be great because I'm going to do this giant thing that the neocons told me to do, the politicians think. And all the libertarians have to say is, don't. Well, what the hell kind of advice is that to tell a politician? Don't. And so they don't ever listen to us. But they do listen to the neocons. So, why do people join up terrorist groups to fight against the United States? Well, if you ask Matthew Alexander, the pseudonymous army interrogator from Iraq, the guy who got the information to target and kill Zarqawi, he said virtually all of the foreign fighters who had traveled to Iraq to fight against the United States came because they originally were motivated by the stories and the pictures of the torture. Well, Alan Dershowitz is one of the first people in America to come out and try to legitimize and legalize torture after September 11th. So, that should mean that we don't listen to him. That should mean we don't listen to him. But he doesn't get on TV and say, don't. He says, yeah, you know what you ought to do? Exercise your power in this way. And so he'll always be welcome back. Same as him and every other neocon too. That's all I wanted to say. I'm sorry that I'm so stupid that I completely forgot my point, especially when I was basically done setting it up, right? I even mentioned the thing about the libertarians' think tanks moved far away and the neocons' think tanks moved close. And then that was it. My next point was, and the politicians listen to the neocons because the neocons are always advocating for something. And so it doesn't matter if it's Bill Kristol who loves to predict things, who never stops predicting things, and is never right about anything, and yet is always recommending absolute horrors and creating consensus about it. He's another one. He's like the evil Doug Bandow. He just never stops. He's a hardcore workaholic. And all he does all day long is get people on the phone. Cindy, get me so-and-so on the phone, he says. And then he gets them on the phone and he says, hey, let's make a think tank. It'll be on a piece of paper in my right-hand desk drawer. And it will advocate for more war for Israel. And they go, okay, I'll call some other people too. And we'll get a bunch of money from Exxon and Lockheed to pay for it. And it'll be great. And we'll have 10 think tanks, and they'll all be in your right-hand desk drawer, Bill. And, you know, it works. The guy works hard, you know, and he's always recommending something. And so, you know, for political types, who can ignore it? Anyway, that's all I want to say. Such a stupid idiot. And, well, what's Bill Kristol recommending? The stupid idiot. He's saying that we should put ground troops in Iraq. He co-wrote a thing back 2 months ago with Fred Kagan saying, put ground troops in Iraq right now. Should have never pulled them out. You should pull them back. Put them back. I thought maybe that would work if I said it that way, but no. Anyway,
And now his writing partner, Fred Kagan, has a new study out for the Institute for the Study of War. And they're saying we need 25,000 ground troops. Because, of course, we need more special forces, and then we need more army to protect the special forces, and then we need, of course, medics and more force protection, and who's going to fly the helicopters, and this is how it is. I mean, come on, you thought this would be the one time? It ain't like that. Already on TV this morning, the expert guest, I think it was Paul Vallely, up there saying, oh, you know, yeah, I mean, God. In fact, the CNN stock question in the anchor's ear was, is it naive and wrong for the president to rule out ground troops already at this point? I mean, we just might need them, right? And of course, it's the bizarro version of my argument that the Iraqi army is not going to be able to take these major cities back from the Islamic State, even with American air support. They can protect the Shiite parts of Iraq, and they can help solidify where those lines are drawn, but they can't really invade Tikrit and Mosul and Fallujah, or I'd be amazed if they could, drive the Islamic State out. If you accept the premise that the Islamic State must be driven out of Mosul, that they be disallowed by facts on the ground from being able to claim that it is the seat of their monopoly on power, then it's going to take the Marines. That's why I'm always predicting the worst, that they're going to send the freaking Marines. And it's going to be a complete horror show. Because there is no other force that can do it. But of course, you know, the CNN version of that is, we gotta send them. Not, well, wait a minute. How the hell are you going to get into a war based on a strategy that everyone agrees can't work? You know, the part that people are the happiest about is the Iraq side. Forget the Syria strategy, they all agree. But in Iraq, yeah, we're going to put together this government that gets along with all factions. It's going to be very inclusive, the new government. And, and then we're going to, you know, back the Iraqi army on the ground, and they're going to take back all this territory. In what fantasy? You know, the Badr Brigade, the Mahdi army, the, how do you say it, something, Al-Haq, whatever, these Iranian-backed Shiite militias, they're not going to go sack Mosul and Tikrit and Fallujah, and there are other cities too, five or six more cities in Iraq. They're not going to be able to take it back. And then, hell, as long as I have 1 minute before the break here, I got to find my section on the moderates here. Okay, look, this is at Moon of Alabama, okay? Moonofalabama.org. It's a great blog there. Real smart guy writes there, and great comment sections too. And this is from the 12th. Some links on that war on ISIS. And he says, on training and arming the moderate rebels, there is pessimism all around. Okay, this is not just from the Scott Hortons of the world, of which you and me are the ones. This is, no one believes in the stated Syria strategy whatsoever. Obama's strategy in Iraq, Syria hinges on long shots, reads the LA Times. Syria rebels, IS, and non-aggression pact, says McClatchy. Syrian rebels will use weapons to fight Assad, whether Obama likes it or not, Daily Beast. Turkish aid to Al-Qaeda-linked groups shows finding allies in Syria tough, McClatchy. Newsweek, Businessweek, New York Times. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. Okay, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here, noon to 3 Eastern Time on Liberty Radio Network. My archives are at scotthorton.org, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, and things like that. All right, good. First guest today is Thomas Harrington. And he is the author of this book, Living La Vida Baroca, new sponsor of the show. And but he's a regular writer for, We feature him pretty damn regularly at antiwar.com. I don't know what you call that. And he also writes for counterpunch.org from time to time. And it's a really great book. It's Living La Vida Baroca, and the subtitle is American Culture in a Time of Imperial Orthodoxies. Just go to scotthorton.org/books, and it's right there at the upper left. Welcome to the show, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well, Scott. Very nice to be here with you.
Very good to have you on the show. Very good to do business with you, too. Very happy to represent your work and try to convince people to buy it. I think everyone will enjoy it a lot. And one of the things I like about it, certainly unique to me, is, you know, obviously you're an American, and so all your writing is about the American Empire, this and that. And I'm not sure exactly what your connection is to Spain. Apparently you live there some of the time or something. Maybe you can tell us about that. But then you have all this great stuff to say about Spanish history and all these great analogies and metaphors and lessons to be learned and all this great stuff. So really unique book and very good. So I'm very happy to have the association. And so, in fact, let's start with that. What is exactly your connection to Spain, sir?
Well, in my day job, I'm a professor of Hispanic studies up at Trinity College in Hartford. I kind of was just a typical American kid from New England who one day marched into Spain and said, this is a great place. And it became an obsession and eventually went back and became a professor, did the whole PhD in that route. And I'm a researcher in contemporary Spain and especially nationalisms within Spain today. And that got me thinking over a number of years about the whole issue of Spain as a great empire. Mm. It tends to be the empire that we don't talk about, although in some ways it's the empire that's most comparable to what we are now. And so over a number of years, I've been reflecting upon Spain's imperial trajectory. And as I live in today's America, I begin to see more and more correspondences between them.
Mm. Yeah, well, as William Graham Sumner said, he described America's victory against Spain in the Spanish-American War as their conquest of us, as we replace them in the scheme of things and in European powers, finally knocking them out of the way, but corrupting what America was supposed to be about by going down that path.
I think that's very clearly so. I happened to be glancing last night at the new Roosevelt documentary on PBS, and of course, Teddy Roosevelt was a driver behind that imperial push of the late 1800s, early 1900s. And really, I think you can make a very strong argument that that's the beginning of the denaturing of the American democratic project as it became involved with empire, and quite frankly so. Although we don't always use the words, we've gone in and out on it, we don't like to talk about ourselves as imperial, but we're clearly imperial. Yeah. And that was a turning point, probably in the American project, and ironically, it was the ending blow to Spain's nearly 400-year role as a great imperial power.
Yeah, it's funny. Nowadays, I think I've seen multiple examples of this where, say, like college textbooks will have a chapter subheading, The Age of Empire, and it's just the Spanish-American War, the Philippine War, whatever. They're done in a few pages. And then that was the end of the American Empire at that point. You know, certainly it was long over by World War I.
Well, yeah, and there's a parallel to that in European history. In college, I studied European history, and during that time, I did the survey course that went from 1500 to the present. And when I got involved with Hispanic studies later on, I said, gee, I don't remember hearing anything about Spain during that time. 1500 to the present, for the first 300 years of that, Spain was a huge in the imperial power. In the first 150 years of that, it was the unquestioned imperial power of the world, and yet my textbooks told me everything about Britain and Germany, and I went back many years later and found that there were exactly two references to the standard textbook on European history on Spain, which was the most powerful country for a lot of that period.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, back sort of to contemporary Spain, I think what you're saying there, a couple of statements back, was that Spain is still an empire, in a sense. You have these different nationalisms, nationalities on the Iberian Peninsula. I think this I'm pretty sure that when I was a little kid, this is one of the very first things I learned about countries. It seems strange to me that Portugal was not part of Spain, just looking at the map. And why not? Well, because they refused to rule from Madrid. That's why, because Madrid was never successfully able to take over that part of the peninsula is all. Kind of one of my, I don't know how young I was when that was first explained to me, but I guess I had a friend who had relationships, family relationships going back to Portugal. So it was brought up at a very young age. And it just looks funny on the map. But really, what we call Spain is a whole bunch of different regions, kind of dominated by an imperial center in the way D.C. dominates Texas, California, and the rest.
Even more so. You're right on, Scott. I mean, the freedom of Portugal is counterbalanced by the lack of freedom of Catalonia. Kind of the imperial center in Spain has had the choice of being able to dominate one, but not the other. They've never been able to dominate both of them. But as you're saying, there's one thing I always talk to my students is there's an incongruence between the nation and the state in Spain. Spain is a state of many nations. It has Catalans, it has Basques, it has Galicians, and then it has Portuguese who managed to create their own state out of their incongruence with their ethnicity. But generally speaking, we think that states and nations are congruent, and they're not in this case. And you're right on when you talk about Spain is still thinking imperially. One of the things that's going on, as some of your listeners will know, is that there's a big movement for independence in Catalonia right now. And the way the Spanish center is responding is very similar to the way we respond to threats to what we see as our natural rights out there in the world. We just discount any historical background, and we say, get back in your place. Do your thing. Go back to being the people we want you to be. And so it's very interesting. Even today, that imperial mindset is very present in the Spanish press coming out of Madrid, and interestingly enough, in the liberal Spanish press. So liberals are no better on this than so-called conservatives. Both have a very clear imperial mindset when it comes to Catalonia and the other nations of Spain.
Mm. Well, so other than just the ability to exercise power, which is the ultimate end itself, what interest does the central government really have in dominating? I mean, for example, I don't know so much about Catalonia these days, but the Basque have been even violently resisting for so long. Why not just let them go? What's the big deal? They're sitting right on top of the copper mine or what?
Well, there is an economic element that is very important. Spain has the paradox of having its two most economically developed areas, Catalonia and the Basque Country, the areas where a different language and culture exist. So there is the economic focus. But I think it goes back deeper than that. It goes back to the idea of really, you can go into the Spanish Middle Ages and talk about the Reconquest, which is the idea of expelling Jews and Arabs from the Iberian Peninsula where they had lived for 700 years. And this idea that you will be Catholic, you will speak one language, and that will be what it will mean to be Spanish. And that mentality fed very nicely into an imperial mentality outside of the peninsula, and it was the imperial mentality inside the peninsula. Here's the project. Either you're with us or against us. And if you're not with us, well, we have the right to make sure that you are.
All right. Very interesting stuff. Hold it right there. We're talking with Thomas Harrington. He's the author of Living La Vida Baroca, American Culture in a Time of Imperial Orthodoxies, a great book of essays. You can find it at scotthorton.org/books. And we'll be back in just a sec. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Thomas Harrington. He's the author of Living La Vida Baroca, American Culture in a Time of Imperial Orthodoxies. And his book is now a sponsor of this show. So I will extra definitely double encourage you to go and buy it. scotthorton.org/books. And actually just got an email in the break there, Thomas, from Bill. He says, went to Amazon through your book page. It's only available from Spain. I guess that's okay, but are there plans to publish it in the U.S. as well, he asks.
That's been a little problem of distribution we've had. The Kindle version is very readily accessible. There's another site called Book Depository, which will get it to you cheaper and pretty directly. And you can get it through a secondary distributor in Georgia who is listed on the website. So
okay,
it's been a little bit of back and forth that I've gone through with the publisher in Spain. It's published in a series in English in Spain through a university press there. So we're working out some of those kinks.
Mm-hmm.
But
if you
buy it from Spain... Pardon me?
You said that's bookdepository.com, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's something new to me that I just discovered the other day and found
out. What a great name for a bookstore website, huh?
Yeah. It's an anomalous publication in that sense, but it's an American Studies series that they do at the University of Valencia over there. And they're the ones that were most interested in it. So.
And tell me about this title.
Yeah, Barroca, Baroque. Obviously, I'm playing off the Ricky Martin song a few years back. I don't know if anyone remembers it any longer.
No,
there was one summer where it was Living La Vida Loca. And I sat down to write and I said, we're living La Vida Barroca. And, of course, Baroque, it's Baroque. What is Baroque? You know, we talk about Baroque music sometimes. We talk about Baroque art. But Baroque is really much more than just forms of art. It's the form of aesthetics that came out of what is called the Counter-Reformation, in Spain. And that was the time during the 16th century where Spain, as the greatest hegemonic power in the world, was faced with uprisings all across Europe, which is virtually controlled through the Habsburg Empire. And those uprisings had to do with the Protestant Reformation. And we always think of the Protestant Reformation as a religious movement, and it's portrayed to us as primarily a religious movement, which it was, of course. But there was a strong geopolitical subtext to the religious movement. Germans didn't want to be ruled by Spain. Dutch didn't want to be ruled by Spain. And what held them together, of course, was the Spanish monarchy, held them under Spain, was the Spanish monarchy in conjunction with the Catholic Church out of Rome, which Spain had an enormous control over. So in effect, these Protestant uprisings were saying, we want our freedom. We want to be able to look at our God in our way through our cultural point of view. And that really was an uprising that lasted for a good 100 years, a series of wars in Europe that were very important. And what's interesting to me is that the Spaniards, much like the Americans today, instead of looking at the grievances that people have against them across the world, the reasons why they might be angry with their rule, they say, no, the problem is you just need to understand, you just need to hear more and more ornately what we are, and you'll ultimately be convinced by what we are. And we obviate the problem of the violence we visit on these people, parole we try and visit on these people. And that's what the Baroque was. The Baroque was, in effect, the aesthetic that grew out of the Counter-Reformation, this propagandistic drive to bring Protestants back to the fold by convincing them about the beauty of the Catholic Church. And the Jesuits were a big part of the Counter-Reformation. So I see a lot of parallels there between our way of responding to the so-called threats we have. I remember when Charlotte Beers was hired by the Bush administration to market the war on terror to the Arabs. So we brought in someone from Madison Avenue and told them, we really do love you, even though we're making war against you. Well, that's in effect what the Spaniards tried to do through the Counter-Reformation and led by the Jesuits. No, really, really. Catholicism is good. But it has another aspect to it that is real interesting, is that within Spain, when there's ideological strictures within a country, there is very little ability to express oneself directly, and I think we see this here in the United States. Oh, I support the troops, don't you? And we're all supposed to get up and clap on cue, or we're supposed to support all of our uniformed people as if they were all heroes. You go to a ball game, and I go to a ball game and I want to watch the ball game, but I have to support someone's idea of who heroes are. There's these implied ideological obligations we have. And what people find after a while is that they tire of doing that, and they begin to not direct criticisms toward them, and they begin to seek refuge in ornateness, misdirection plays, all of the fluff that we now celebrate in our media. And that's very Baroque to me, because that's what the Spanish Baroque did. Its poetry sought ornamentation so as not to have to run into the problems of the ideological restrictions that existed in the society.
I see. Well, first of all, it's really interesting about the culture of Spain during that Counter-Reformation period, and that's the way they reacted. And then the parallel, of course, is pretty plain. It sounds like, even if it's not necessarily always getting down to such, you know, how many angels can dance on a head of a pin kind of questions, it's still always just irrelevancies. It's still always just a refusal to ask and answer the real questions about what the hell the situation is.
Exactly.
We see this especially in foreign policy where, I mean, a lot of times anyway, I live in Austin. What the hell do I know about D.C.? But it sure seems to me like a lot of times these people lie, and they know they're lying, and they turn right around and believe their own damn lie and base their policy on the narrative that they were trying to construct to fool you and me, and they end up fooling themselves with it and go ahead and make the most horrible mistakes based on what they knew wasn't right in the first place, you know?
Well, and this is one of the, you probably saw in the book, one of my pet peeves is how people who are given the luxury, like I have been given, of being able to spend time reading books and studying and traveling, it's incumbent upon us to ask hard questions. And sometimes, oftentimes, we don't. Last night, I was with a couple of friends, both professors, and we were talking about the problem in the Ukraine. And these are very bright people who've traveled, read in other languages, et cetera. Not that that's a proof of anything, but it certainly helps in gaining perspective. And they could not dislodge their minds from the narrative of Putin's evilness. Even when I was trying to point out very salient facts about what Putin has done and hasn't done, the things that Ray McGovern talks about on your program, the ability of the narrative to overwhelm even the people that are supposed to be the guardians on some level or another of educated discourse, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And that, again, was similar during the Spanish Golden Age. An empire, above all, needs narratives to keep people in line. And we're finding that the media, as it exists, does a very, very, very good job of that. Mm. And people aren't asking the right questions about it.
Right. Well, as that veteran of the Spanish Civil War, George Orwell, wrote in 1984, the propaganda is mostly for the powerful anyway, right? Because the proles, us regular folks, what we say and think doesn't matter anyway. So you can watch football, you can smoke cigarettes or do whatever you want, but the party people are the ones who have to be most indoctrinated in all the cheerleading. And I think back to, and I know that partisanship has a lot to do with this too, of course, but the run-up to the Iraq War, where they announced a year and a half in advance, we're going to lie you into war for the next year and a half, and then we're going to start a war. And so we had not just every chance, we had more than every chance, all of us, to know better and to disallow it. And it was and I was driving a cab at the time, so I got the perfect kind of random sample of everybody. And it's the doctors and the lawyers and the well-educated and the know-it-alls who know nothing. And, you know,
exactly.
They're the ones who are most impressionable when it comes to what all us smart people know and think, right, guys? Kind of crap. And, you know, they're ridiculous, basically. And, you know, I've had conversations with people who make, you know, who have millions of dollars, own giant businesses, are surgeons or whatever. And they're complete dimwits. They know nothing other than, you know, cheer for the fascist state. It's ridiculous. It's crazy. I just said ridiculous twice. Sorry. But it is. It's too silly to be crazy.
Hugely important point, Scott. And believe it or not, there's another. I look at the way national identities are formed in Spain in the contemporary era. And what's interesting, and you put your hand on it, your hand in the fire on it, is that national identities can even be formed by a very compact, small group of people. And then sold to the rest of the populace. And this is what I think is one of the most disturbing things of our time. people think, well, there's more information than ever. There's more ability of people to have the to understand the world than ever. And there's this idea that large narratives of the powerful few have been broken down. I would argue it's just the opposite. The ability of small groups of people to propagate their narratives and have them believed is greater than ever. Mm. And the people who are supposed to be doing the job of criticizing them are asleep at the wheel. And that gets, I think one of the real dangers is the gap between the ability to manipulate from on high and the ability of people to critically pull those discourses apart mm-hmm. is bigger than it's ever been. And they can just generate realities, and people, for the most part, buy them.
Yeah,
and they
look
at people who might listen to dissident voices and say, you're kooky.
Right. Yeah, no, it's such an important point. We should never forget that all these technologies, as wonderful as they are for as many reasons as they are, they've all been subsidized by the U.S. state this whole time for a very important reason, enslaving mankind. And at best, what we have is their double-edged sword that we can try to use against them, you know, back against them. That's what this show is, right? It's their internet, and I'm trying to, you know, at least have my say to try to push back my millionth of 1% for whatever it's worth, you know? And, you know, that's what you're doing with your writing and all of this. But it's their technology, and it was created for exactly the purposes that you say. I mean, other than just tracking us like packages everywhere we go, but also for, you know, reaching into every nook and cranny of our brain, you know?
I think they've made I think it's a new paradigm that we've been sort of awakened to, that they've made a very clear calculation. Let anyone find the information they want anywhere, if they have the ability to do it. But in the meantime, we will flood them with such nonsense and such indiscriminate types of information that only very few people with a lot of stamina or a lot of time on their hands or whatever will actually clue themselves in. And so it's a very interesting system in that it doesn't have to restrict people with a heavy hand the way they had to do it in East Germany. They let everything be out there, and yet emphases are still being controlled by who wants to control them. And we can sit on the margins, and we can find out a lot of things, and yet our ability to generate an echo out of what we know is fairly limited.
Yeah. Hey, at least we get to say I told you so all the time.
Which only irritates people more.
I know it. Hey, listen, we're over time, and the live audience isn't even getting to hear this part, so I better let you go now, and the archive will be up. Everyone will be able to hear the whole thing, and then, you know, let's do this regularly for the next little while till I'm done questioning you about all the great stuff you wrote in this book here.
All right. Thanks, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
All right, y'all. That's Thomas Harrington. The book is Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in a Time of Imperial Orthodoxies. It's really great. It's at scotthorton.org/books. Go and help support. Thanks very much. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day, is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West, while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal as we knew it is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, the end of that interview was really interesting. You should go to the archives later and listen to it. Boy, am I no good at these hard breaks. No good, I tell you. I try. I fail. All right. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. I'm Scott Horton. Our next guest on the show today is our good friend Grant Smith from the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. That's IRMEP, IRMEP.org, IRMEP.org. And he's got a whole mess of books about the Israel lobby and their crimes in America. The latest is Divert, Numek, Zalman Shapiro, and the diversion of U.S. weapons-grade uranium into the Israeli nuclear weapons program. He is director of IRMEP. I already said that. Sorry. Hey, welcome back to the show. Oh, where are you, Grant? I can't hear you, Grant. Oh, I heard something, Grant.
Can you hear me?
There you are.
You got me now?
Yeah, now
okay,
I got you.
Sorry about that. Thanks for having me back. In stereo, no less.
Oh, yeah, very good. Hey, very happy to have you here.
Great to be here, Scott.
We're going to have to work out this sound. Give me some sound check here. Say check one, two, or something.
Check one, two, three.
All right. Yeah, that's a little better there. I turned it up.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, it's Grant Smith. He's got a new piece right now at antiwar.com. DOJ demands immunity for anti-Iran group Yuani. Yuani? United Against Nuclear Iran. Hey, Grant, what's United Against Nuclear Iran?
It's a good question, Scott. It appears to be something more than just a run-of-the-mill 501c3 nonprofit corporation, a charity, if you will, given tax exemption by the IRS, formed in 2007, I believe. It's a small organization with a very big board of advisors and directors, including Dennis Ross, the Uber lobbyist for all things Middle East, Gary Seymour, former White House coordinator for arms control, Mark Wallace, financial guy. And of course, former director of the Mossad, the Israeli Mossad, Meir Dagan, and Joseph Lieberman, former senator. So it's a small organization with a very high-profile board of former government officials, all of whom, and this is relevant, would have in their former and perhaps even current capacities security clearances and access to intelligence flows.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's get to that in a second, but right now we're still between the interim deal, the now extended interim deal, and the final negotiations on a final status for the position of Iran's nuclear program, compared to the UN Security Council and America's position. They're working it out, and the Israel lobby has been trying to undo that. How powerful is this group? How much effect do they have, relatively speaking, in Washington, D.C., in trying to undermine the nuclear deal, get new sanctions passed, that kind of thing?
Oh, a great deal. This group is a very specialized group in that it, rather than do what AIPAC and some of the other nodes of the Israel lobby do, which is propose legislation that would have the effect of, you know, putting in sanctions, whereas the government's trying to use the idea of lifting sanctions as a carrot. This organization, through an uncanny ability to obtain secret corporate documents and an uncanny ability to point commercial satellites, has a constant campaign of incitement against companies and individuals it says are undermining the global boycott against Iran and possibly aiding its nuclear program, which they insist is, of course, a weaponization program going against everything most people who follow this closely actually know. So they're an important specialty organization. I think the fact that they're so young and have managed to get themselves in so much trouble in such a short period of time speaks to what it actually is. And I would say that the evidence points to it being yet another front for, in this case, laundering intelligence into public relations.
Yeah. Well, they sound like a bunch of McCarthyites, basically, just going around accusing everybody and then no accountability. So why not?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, they've now they've been sued by a Greek shipping magnate by the name of Victor Restis, who They claim, on the evidence of a couple of documents they mysteriously obtained and refused to release, they claim that he had been involved or considering involvement in some projects with the Iranians. He denies it, and they've gone to quite a bit of lengths to put out a lot of publicity that the government wouldn't really be in a position to do. I mean, of course, there's the U.S. Treasury Department's list of you know, people not to do business with. But this organization, on the basis of some fairly flimsy allegations, mounts major campaigns against corporation individuals, shippers, all sorts of people, all in the name of enforcing the boycott against Iran, which I believe they interpret broadly, and maybe corporate lawyers a little bit more narrowly for businesses in the region and elsewhere. So they've had a major role in this sort of gray area of taking allegations and using them against corporations and individuals to really blacklist them and encourage others not to do business with them. And in the case of Restis, he claims that their allegations were unfounded and sued them for defamation in the Southern District Court of New York, saying that they had cost him billions of dollars. And he's also in the process of his lawsuit trying to recover damages, begun to engage in standard discovery processes against the organization's board of directors to see where they were getting their information that they were using against him, and also try and see a little bit more about the funding flows of this organization. And that has led to an extreme response by the U.S. government.
Yeah, well, all right, we still got a couple of minutes. Give us the short version of the extreme response, and then we'll get to the follow-ups on the other side.
Yeah, extreme response. The Justice Department is tipped off, probably by United Against the Nuclear Iran, in February, and begins to intervene in this civil suit, and has just now, as of last Friday, said to the judge, you have to shut this entire thing down. We don't care if Restis was smeared or what his concerns are. This group has information which, if disclosed, could jeopardize U.S. national security. So that's
shut down the whole case. Sorry, I had to jump in. The whole case, not just we have to exclude some information.
Exactly. The whole thing. Shut it down. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And so I wonder then, is there any indication that these guys... Well, no, I mean, I guess they're working with the DOJ. It's not like the Rosa Weissman case where they kind of graymailed them and said, we're going to release all this stuff.
No, this appears they're acting more like any U.S. government agency would. Mm-hmm. Like if the CIA is being sued or if the Treasury Department is being sued, what they quickly do is they go to the Justice Department and cry wolf and try and get the best legal representation they can to get the thing thrown out of court. These guys are acting more like a branch of the federal government than a nonprofit corporation.
Yeah. Wow. So that's really something else. I believe it's only an invention of the Bush era that they get whole cases thrown out on state secrets privilege.
Right.
Rather than just specific documents or something. Because after all federal judges have, don't they all have security clearance for this kind of stuff to look at themselves and back in their own office? If not, you know, in open court?
They can do what's called, an in-camera review. So they have that right. Hmm.
Man, this is really something else. All right, hold it right there, y'all. We'll be right back with Grant F. Smith. We're talking about his newest piece at antiwar.com. DOJ demands immunity for anti-Iran group because they've been giving them classified information in order to destroy people with, sometimes on false accusations, apparently. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm talking with Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. IRMEP.org, IRMEP.org. His latest book is Divert, about the Israelis stealing weapons-grade uranium from a plant in Pennsylvania. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But right now, we're talking about his piece that's running right now at antiwar.com. It's called DOJ Demands Immunity for Anti-Iran Group, Yuani. And it's this group that, well, what? It's openly run by the former director of Mossad. So,
right. Does that tell you anything?
It's a non-profit organization, you understand. And what they do is they accuse people and they try to get people prosecuted or sick the Treasury Department on people for violating the sanctions in any way. And in this case, they're being sued by this Greek shipping magnate. I guess if you call him that, that means he's really rich and is the type of guy who typically has the power to fight back about something like this. Is that right?
Right. He didn't have to take any of this on the chin if he felt he had been poorly handled. So, yeah, he's, you know, $100 million in business and billions in interest. So, yeah, he's a big item. And he's, by the way, not even opposed to, you know, keeping Iran from getting nuclear weapons. He's stated very clearly that he shouldn't even be a target of this group. And when he goes to court to make his case, Uncle Sam steps in after being alerted by this group to come in and just blow the thing out of court. Mm-hmm. So it's a rather drastic escalation. But, you know, as the article states, this isn't the first sort of front organization that has either been moving intelligence or weapons or classified information on behalf of Israel. No, of course not. You've got MarTech. You've got the Sonnenborn Foundation. You've got, you know, as Juan Cole has probably accurately characterized it, the Middle East the Middle East Research Institute that puts out as much hyperbolic press from the Arab speaking world and recycles it into the U.S. He has said, well, you know, if it's run by Israeli intelligence, former intelligence agent, and it doesn't have the monetary might to actually do all of this primary sourcing, it's probably just recycling intercepts from Israel, which seems plausible to me. And in the article, of course, we mentioned the fact that an Israeli agent, Dan Halpern, a government official, passed classified information to AIPAC when it was trying to pass a trade agreement. We've gone over that quite a few times. Mm-hmm. So none of this is new if you know the history, if you kind of look at this as yet another part of the Israel lobbying, you know, network in this country, and compare it to past activities. It's actually not that new. The only thing that's new here and somewhat outrageous is that a lot of these organizations in the Israel lobby have former government officials and former Israeli officials. And if now the standard is that if they get into trouble, they can simply claim that one or more of these officials has classified information, what does that do for accountability? Will this set a precedent, basically, of immunity for a lot of organizations that have been engaged in mostly unpunished activity that appears to violate the law, or at least any sort of sense of due process in this country? It's a case that a lot of people put last Friday on their calendars to see what the government would ask, thinking that maybe there'd be some way to segregate whatever classified information issue there is. And the fact that the government said, no, there isn't any way to proceed with this case without jeopardizing classified information strongly points to this organization either recycling things from the Treasury Department, the NSA, or Israeli intelligence, or recycling intelligence that was provided by the NSA to the Israelis and then back into the U.S. We don't know, and the government says we don't have a right to know. So it's a crazy situation that a lot of just purely sort of judicial watch type organizations have been just flabbergasted by.
Yeah, I see what you mean about how that could create an incredible precedent, but maybe in a good way. Can any of us from now on, whenever we're ordered in discovery to turn over anything, say, oh, no, I have some classified stuff that I know a guy who knows a guy who gave it to me, and so
Of course not. Of course not. Of course not.
Oh, I'd have to be an agent of a foreign power for the U.S. government to protect me in that way. Is that right?
If you weren't lobbying for this prime directive that I mentioned in the article that came from Glenn Greenwald's reporting on Snowden, you know, if you're not working for the advancement of Israel, I would say forget it. You're going to jail, buddy, because then the law will be applied. You will. But I think it's troubling because there only seem to be a couple of explanations for why the government's wading in. It's either because this organization is doing something that's against the law, which is conducting sort of a intelligence type propaganda operation in the U.S. in cahoots with some U.S. government agency, and they don't want anybody to know about it, or it really is engaged in illegal activity. And Eric Holder, who has a record going back to Mark Rich, pardoning him when he was just giving advice to the Clintons, he has a record of capitulating. He's kind of a poster boy for what the Justice Department always does in this situation, which is, in his case, visit with the Israelis and then refuse to oppose a complete pardon for Mark Rich, who is apparently not only engaged in a lot of financial crime, but also an Israeli intelligence asset. So, you know, that sort of immunity has already been creeping up on America. And you tend to look at the career trajectory of someone like Eric Holder and just say, well, I can see why some people would want him in place for just this sort of situation. And he's already talked about this case. He's waded in and said, no, we cannot let this case proceed. The New York Times reported on that. But it is. I just think it's a travesty of justice. It's just one more bit of evidence that some organizations and groups just operate beyond the law with the full support of a very pliant Justice Department.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we don't have time, so I guess we'll have to talk about Nixon and Israeli nukes later. I wanted to ask you about this new document that had come out. But
we'll
do that soon. But so what was the other thing I was going to say then? Nah, I don't remember anymore. Damn. That's twice today. I've completely forgotten what the hell I was going to say, Grant.
Well, you're probably going to say, hey, it's great to talk over Skype. And I'm in full agreement. This is great. I can hear you much clearer.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely better than your phone.
Excellent.
What was it going to be? Well, I know something that I was going to say a few minutes ago that I didn't get a chance to say, which was when you mentioned Greenwald in Israel. Someone just tweeted me this morning, hey, what was that story about America, the NSA turning over stuff to the Israelis? Yeah, it was all of it. They turn over everything to the Israelis. Here it is in The Guardian, reported by Glenn Greenwald. It got the least press of almost any Snowden story that's come out yet. No mentions in the New York Times or any Royal Scrant, but NSA turns it all over.
That war in The Intercept, huh?
Yeah, yeah. They're doing good work over there. All right. Hey, man, thanks very much for your time. I'll get you back on. We'll talk about Nixon and the nukes in a minute here.
I'll be there.
All right. Thanks. We'll be right back, y'all. That's Grant Smith, IRMEP.org. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, I'm sorry, I do got to talk about Rand Paul, but just for a second. I'm not going to go on and on about it, I swear to God. You know what, that never works when I say that, does it? Well, so there's two news stories here. One in the Washington Post, shifting his views, Rand Paul seeks broader appeal, but may risk his outsider image. And then there's the Politico, Rand Paul. As world changes, you change. And that's because, as they correctly describe it, he's criticized Obama for not doing enough. Although, he's been really good, actually, on explaining why it's all Obama's fault for the war in Libya and Syria getting us into this mess. He has been good on that. But he does say, you know, if it was me, I'd march. I don't know what he's waiting for. I'd march right down to the Congress. I'd demand a declaration of war, and then I'd go war the crap out of those guys until they're gone. Something like that. And the thing of it is this, is it doesn't matter whether it's this or 100 other issues. I don't have to name them. You already know them. Rand Paul's reputation now is not as basically the son of Ron Paul and mostly like him or whatever. It's now becoming flipper-flopper first. Waffler. And for it before he was against it kind of a guy. And, you know, that's the biggest reason John Kerry lost the election in 2004. Is nobody knew what he was talking about because he changed every day to try to fit what he thought you wanted to hear. And so instead of being everything to everyone, he was nothing to nobody. Don't you hate John Kerry? God, what a horrible guy. Anyway, so Rand Paul's problem is he's trying to be everything to everybody. And instead, he's going to end up being nothing to no one. He's going to be known. He already is becoming known as so ambitious, he changes his position on any and everything all the time. That's becoming like, you know, if he was a caricature drawn on the boardwalk or whatever, that would be his exaggerated feature. His absolute shamelessness and willingness to pander. And that's really bad for Brand Rand, dude, if you're running for president, to have people confused all the time as to what you're about. And here's the real point, of course, is that if he would just take, every time someone attacked his dad, if he would just say, oh, hell yeah, thank you for pitching me a softball. Watch me knock it out of the park. Let me tell you the 17 reasons why he's right and you don't know what you're talking about. Blam! And he's in the Senate, so never even mind running for president. He could be the greatest senator in world history. He could be the most truth-tellingest senator. He could be turning Washington, D.C. upside down right now. Go ahead and lead. You don't have to pander. Go ahead. First of all, get right and then lead. Oh, no, just one more intervention over there in Iraq's going to solve all our problems. Is that it? We'll get to completely debunking the entire narrative of this strategy here in just a moment. Go ahead and be like your father, only with less stuttering. And listen, I worship Ron Paul. That's the only thing I can say bad about him is that sometimes he made it a little bit hard to understand what he was saying if he didn't already know what he was saying. But whatever. I mean, I worship Ron Paul in a thousand ways. But so Rand could be just like that, only more forceful and a little bit easier to understand, not quite so esoteric, right? And he could just be completely changing the world right now. And instead, there's two stories on the same day about how, man, with this guy, just keeps changing his mind all the time about stuff. Oh, and then lying about it. I never said I was for cutting off aid to Israel. Really? Here's footage of you saying, yes, even Israel. Okay? So stop lying and saying that you never flip-flop when we all got the internet. It's the same damn thing I tried to scream at Bob Barr back in 2012 or 2008 after Ron Paul had dropped out of the Republican nomination and Barr was running as a libertarian. I said, just be as much like Ron as you can. Be as anti-everything as you can. You know? I mean, hell, I know you're Bob Barr and you're pretty good for a conservative on some things or whatever. But just go out there and give him your best Ron imitation. No. Same thing with Rand. Your father's actually better than you on all this stuff. Don't back away from his positions. Double down on them and win. And you can tell I'm upset just because of how let down I am. He's the son of the greatest congressman ever. Best one ever. Last best hope America had. And you know what? Yeah, it's true. The media would have made fun of him. Someone tweeted me, yeah, the media would have just made fun of Ron Paul and marginalized him and ruined him and whatever. There would have been a lot of that. But you know what? At the same time, he would have been able to, you know, basically for, you know, one way or another, he would force through at least most of his Freedom Restoration Act from 2007. His Repeal the 21st Century Act. He would undo a lot of harm. And he never had much of a positive agenda other than stopping doing horrible things. So it would have been hard for them to stop him from stopping stuff. DEA, you're instructed to, you know, lay off everyone starting now. You're no more SWAT raids from any federal agency. You know, stuff like that. It'd be so much fun to have a Ron Paul presidency. Anyway, I'm way off in fantasy land now. How about I'll settle for Rand just being right and leading? And, you know, I knew this the first time I interviewed him in 2009. Boy, did I get... So many people got so mad at me on Facebook and everything. I used to troll around there back then. And people got so mad at me for saying, like, hey, man, listen to it. Read it and weep. He's bad on Afghanistan. He's bad on Guantanamo. He's bad on prosecuting torturers, which means the rule of law is subject to political expedience. Out of the gate. And there were a lot of other things wrong with it, too. But it was just bad enough that, oh, I see how you are. I see how you're going to be. And then for him to say, yeah, we need to declare war on ISIS. And I know that he tried, Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com says, no, he's saying let the Kurds do it. Nah, not really. He's saying America has to take responsibility for the result here. And that can only guarantee worse results. All right, it went on too long. I'm sorry. Here's why that can only guarantee worse results. The one and only solution, if there is one in Iraq to the ISIS problem, is for the Sunni tribal system to rise up and throw the Islamist suicide bomber kooks out. And it's not going to be easy, and maybe it's not even possible in the very shortest term, but America's not going to be able to go in there and recreate the awakening and put these guys all back under American command and finance and all that. I mean, that's a one in a million shot. And as I've said a million times, and as I'm going to keep saying over and over every day, because I think this is my primary responsibility now, it doesn't make any sense to say that they're going to use the Iraqi army and all the Shiite militias to do it. First of all, I don't even think that's possible. And second of all, if it could, all you're doing is bringing the Shiite militias deep into Sunni territory in order to dislodge ISIS. But is that how it looks to every Sunni in Iraq? Oh, it can only explode right in your face. You know, each and every Shiite militiaman might as well be the Ayatollah Khomeini to, you know, in Daniel Pipe's mind, to the Sunnis of Iraq, okay? That's how fearful they are of the Shiites and how desperately they don't want that to happen. And it's just going to make them rally around ISIS and blah, blah, blah. I got 1,000 more reasons on the other side of this break where this strategy just can't work. No strategy can from the American intervention point of view. Can't do nothing but make it worse. So stop it. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Oh yeah, and that's the other thing. America is not a limited constitutional republic or a democracy or anything like that. The fact that Rand Paul's the front runner right now doesn't mean anything. Just because the people, even if they did want him, if they do want him, that still doesn't mean anything. And Rand Paul is never going to be granted power by people with power. Wall Street banks, arms manufacturers, big agribusiness. I mean, he may have his energy allies in Kentucky or some kind of thing like that. But he's going to bring together the power factions that make presidents in America. Think the Israel lobby is ever going to trust him no matter how bad he panders to them? No. The same reason we all want to love him, even though he's horrible, is the same reason that they will never allow him the power. His last name. the tree that he fell far from. And so it's as simple as that. So all this pandering really is for nothing. The fact that he became a senator is awesome. He could be the world's greatest senator if he wasn't trying to be president so bad. And in fact, if he'd be the world's greatest senator for, say, I don't know, another 6 years, and then run for president then, after helping lead the country to a much more libertarian position, then maybe they wouldn't be able to resist. But at this point, nah. You're more likely to get some Ted Cruz or close enough type Republican nominee, and Hillary Clinton on the other side walks right in over the face of standard cookie cutter Republican congressional or governor jerk face. That's who's going to get the nomination. It's pretty simple. You know, you don't have to be a expert political scientist in America to know that, yeah, it's not really up to what the people want anyway. Only in the most magical metaphysical sense, you know? Like I used to always complain about the Ron Paul thing. He could have won. If only, you know, 200 million Americans had insisted, right? Anything short of that wasn't going to do it. And they had the responsibility to insist, and they didn't because they suck. And so, didn't happen. But, you know, if everyone who was good on peace and liberty had bum-rushed the Republican primary, there would have been no denying. And all the caucuses and whatever. He'd have been 10, 20 points ahead in every case, and they wouldn't have had a choice but to submit to that. But instead, all the people who are good on peace and liberty in America did not do that. I did. I voted in the primaries for Ron Paul both times. But, anyway, that's what it would have taken. And, of course, that didn't want to happen. Because people don't care that much. It wouldn't have taken anything like 200 million. It would have taken the consensus of 200 million to get 50,000 people to even turn out in each state or something, you know? But anyway, I don't believe in the structure of the Madisonian system to deliver the right, the closest to best that you could get to the highest offices in America. And that's what they had in mind, you know, that like, hey, you know, the people who are the very best qualified when it all sifts out will end up being the ones, yeah, most qualified to serve the interests of foreign powers and arms manufacturers. Not so much the national interest. Have they ever even heard of that? They have any conception of what it might be outside of their own interests? But anyway, I don't know. And you know, especially when this Iraq war thing is such a teachable moment, it's just perfect. Hey, look, we've never had an enemy in Iraq so weak before. Saddam Hussein and his army, you know, they could beat the crap out of ISIS in a minute if they were here. Ahem. These guys are really nothing. If anything, you know, beef up the federal intelligence and police agencies to keep them out of Western Europe and America. If you've gone through Turkey to Syria to go fight, well, you're in no man's land now, pal, and you're not allowed back on this side of the line ever. Fine. But going to war against ISIS can only make them stronger. It's playing directly into their hands, and everybody who knows it and says so, and yet they persist. What are they supposed to do? Nothing, really? And you can see it from Rand's point of view, the politician. What am I supposed to do? I'm really supposed to say in the face of these beheading videos and whatever that we should really do nothing? But what will they say about me? Yeah, well, they're going to say, oh, you flip-flopped again, huh? They're not even going to, you know, praise you for your new horrible position. They're just going to say, yeah, you never can make up your mind about anything, can you? But anyway, so if the old strategy, which he has roundly denounced for Syria, which was back the rebels against Assad, was crazy as he says it is, and oh yeah, then the new policy is just as crazy. It's the exact same thing. And yet he doesn't propose because he wouldn't dare propose to just outright say, or does he say, let's outright turn right around and back Assad against them? Or just stop backing them against him. Assad and the state army of Syria are the only force capable of destroying ISIS, and especially if that is supposed to include al-Nusra too. And they can't do that as long as America continues backing their enemies. But of course, as Michael Scheuer explained to Lou Dobbs on Fox News, you could look up the clip online, just type in Michael Scheuer, Lou Dobbs, Fox News. He said, no, don't back Assad either. And you know Michael Scheuer, he would just as soon line up every last anybody who ever thought about being buds with ISIS or Al-Qaeda in any sense and shoot them. He don't care. He's no libertarian. You might well imagine that he would say, yes, back Assad and let Assad go and bring death to these guys. That's the kind of thing that Michael Scheuer might say. But what does he say? He says, no, don't do that, because then we're aligning with the Iranians and the hated Alawites against the Sunnis again, which in the short term can feel good, but is only going to blow up in your face. Just like backing the Iraqi army, which is nothing but the Badr Brigade of the Supreme Islamic Council of Iraqi traitors who serve Iran. Just like backing them and backing the Shiite militias is going to explode right in your face in Sunni Iraq, too. The best solution is there is no solution, and you finally recognizing that and stopping it already. I don't know. Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon, they thought it'd be a good idea to back Saddam. They tilted toward the Soviets for a little while there in the 70s with some tank purchases and stuff. But then by 1980 at least, Jimmy Carter was ready to give him the green light to go ahead and invade Iran for us. And the encouragement and the promise of help to come. Ronald Reagan picked up that policy, back Saddam. George H.W. Bush came in and baited Saddam. His Secretary of State, James Baker III, baited him into invading Kuwait and then refused to negotiate an exit from Kuwait. He had a million chances to negotiate an exit from Kuwait, but George H.W. Bush would not accept Saddam's offer of surrender. And so they launched that war, then occupied the bases in Saudi Arabia in order to contain and blockade and bomb Iraq for all of the Clinton years, and really the rest of the George H.W. Bush, all the Clinton in the beginning of the George W. Bush years. And what was that bombing about? It was about keeping down the Shiite uprising and keeping Saddam really from keeping it down, as well as protecting basically the sovereignty, the autonomy at least, of the Kurds up in the north. Because after America made an enemy out of Saddam, George H.W. Bush encouraged the Kurds and the Shia to rise up against him. And then let him keep his attack helicopters to massacre them all. And I can't remember the guy's name, this one great journalist that was on the show, he said American helicopters even landed on the highways to prevent an Iraqi army division from marching on Saddam's palace. He was done. And the Americans, literally, directly intervened to stop them from overthrowing him then. So that was in 91. So then they kept him under total blockade that whole time, under the theory that all the starving, dying Iraqis would overthrow him for making them so miserable, when of course that doesn't work. And then George Jr. decided he was going to take the opportunity to prove to his dad that he was a tougher guy than him and this and that kind of crap. And also Ariel Sharon wanted a regime change too over there. And Dick Cheney had run Halliburton into the ground in the 1990s because he's no businessman. He's a hack politician, so he decided he was going to make them some money back with some army contracts and this kind of thing. And so they decided to invade Iraq. They turned all of the Sunni triangle into Osama bin Laden, jihadi stan, wonderland there, now 11 years and counting. And they turned all the land from Baghdad to Basra after a massive civil war where the American and Marine Corps were the useful dupes of the Iranian militias, really, fighting for years to cleanse Baghdad of all the Sunni Arabs for the Shiites and creating Ayatollah's stand, George W. Bush's stand in the south, which has led to the crisis today. And then now they want us to go in there and invade the Islamic State and ally back again with the Iranians and their Shiite sock puppets against those who already have found cause to support ISIS before we've ever embarked on any such madness. The Turks won't help. The coalition's a giant joke. The French are going to help bombing. The Brits aren't even going to send planes this time. Our NATO allies, the Turks, they're not going to lift a finger. The whole thing is a giant catastrophe waiting to happen. And I was, as I was saying about the certainly the Syria side of the war, people are a little bit more gullible on the Iraq part of it and how it's supposed to work. But on the Syria side, the consensus all around in the media is that no one believes it's going to work. Back the moderates, a whole new third force of moderates to fight Nusra, ISIS, al-Sham, and the Islamic Front and Assad and his Iranian-Russian Hezbollah-backed army. Give me a break. So anyway, yeah, that's what everybody knows better than as this war is even just getting going. And before. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, guys, so chat room, I'm interested what you guys think about this, man. So, John Walsh wrote a thing for antiwar.com. I guess we ran on the blog. Just Raimondo wrote a thing for antiwar.com. And Robert Perry wrote a thing at Consortium News. You may have seen others along the same lines, speculating that this war against ISIS, at least as far as it goes in Syria, is still just cover for regime change against Assad in Damascus. Now, I gotta say, I think I still am 51% disagree with that. Just because, and I know this sounds really naive and stupid, doesn't it? That's crazy! That's absolutely insane now. And in fact, I even think I could say that there would be some political pressure against that at this point. When it is just such an established scientific fact that he is the most powerful non-ISIS enemy of ISIS force in the country. To fight against Assad and the Baathist regime now would be like de-Baathifying Iraq back in 2003. You don't want to do that. Not right now. It's just, it's such madness. It couldn't possibly be. But Israel wants regime change in Syria. And so therefore, the Democratic and Republican parties want regime change in Syria. The lobby in D.C. wants regime change in Syria. The consensus is still forged by the fringe kooks who have all the money and all the ears pointed toward their mouths. And that's why, and I was sarcastically, you might have heard me in months past, I've been sarcastically joking that only Washington, D.C.'s treason on behalf of Israel has prevented full-scale war and invasion against ISIS so far. If Obama had not been backing these guys in Syria, if this wasn't an Israeli policy that we want to support Mujahideen rebels to overthrow Assad, or at least failing that, to just keep him at war forever. If that wasn't their policy and this had just somehow happened instead, you know, otherwise, whatever. Anyway, that's the word I was searching desperately for. Then Obama would have just started carpet bombing the crap out of them full scale and sending in the Army and the Marines too, probably back in June. But he's got this huge dilemma, which is we all know that his policy the last 3 years has been to overthrow Assad. and to back the rebels in trying to overthrow him. So now, as absolutely insane and treasonous and asinine as that has been this whole time, now that it's come to these consequences, they have to do something about, you know, Bin Laden reincarnate up there, speaking on the balcony and declaring a caliphate. They still have all of this, you know, bureaucratic momentum toward the regime change policy against Assad still. And they can't just turn it around. And they sure as hell can't just turn it around when you have so many people who put Israel first trying to obfuscate. I saw people, someone said to me, did you see that David Frum wrote a really good piece? It's all very anti-war. And I thought, David Frum? The guy who wrote the Axis of Evil speech where he pretended that Saddam and the Ayatollah were allies? The author of the Bush hagiography, The Right Man, co-author and lick spittle to Richard Pearl in their book, An End to Evil. Yes, we're going to end evil by overthrowing Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Get it? That David Frum, and you read his article at The Atlantic, he says, you're just going to help Iran. You're just going to help Syria. So don't. In other words, David Frum is Michael Oren. David Frum is thinking, like always, Israel first. And as Michael Oren put it, we prefer these bad guys to those bad guys. And really, it sounds unbelievable. It sounds like a lie. It sounds like you shouldn't believe me. You should, you know, use your favorite brand of search engine to double check and make sure that that's really true. What kind of slander is it to say, is it really right that Michael Oren said, and specifically said, he prefers the suicide bombers of ISIS and Nusra to Assad? Because they and Hezbollah are backed by Iran? Yep, that's what he said. Go and double check. He said it to the Jerusalem Post last October, and he said it at a forum in Aspen on YouTube, featuring Jeffrey Goldberg, I guess, is kind of hosting, and he's the guest there. Former, at that point, former ambassador. At the time he spoke to the Jerusalem Post, he was still the current Israeli ambassador to the United States. Not like this is the only information we have about that being Israel's policy, but it's the most stark one, because he doesn't just say, yeah, we want to get rid of ISIS. He acknowledges, of Assad. He acknowledges that, yeah, isn't it crazy? I'm still saying that in an era of ISIS, too. But, yep, because Iran. Same reason Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg, in the Atlantic magazine back in 2012, that his policy was to overthrow Assad, to change the regime, not just to weaken, but to change the regime in Damascus, because that would weaken Iran's position in the Middle East to separate them from their last allied Arab Shia state there. So, well, the only Arab Shia state, but their last allied state in the region. And so, yeah, let's do it, they agreed. So, in an ironical kind of way, this insane policy of supporting the Mujahideen for the last 3 years, because that's what Israel wanted, has prevented Obama from just outright declaring a full-scale war against ISIS. But that'll benefit Iran. But that'll benefit Assad, cry the Israel lobby, in a sense as a weird, bizarro, perverted version of peaceniks in D.C. No, it's just because they like ISIS more, which is what I don't think you could say about any of the rest of us. But, yeah, David Frum and Michael Oren. And Michael Oren is clearly speaking for Benjamin Netanyahu when he says so, too, in the clip in Aspen. And just Google it. Just O-R-E-N, Aspen, and Sunnis. It'll come right up on YouTube for you there in your first Google search results. And he says over and over again, now listen, I'm only speaking for myself, all right? But also over and over again, he says, so from the point of view of the Israeli government, which I am part of and identify with, you know, yeah, we know, dude, thanks. Crazy. But in a way, I'm a little bit thankful for it in that absolutely insane kind of way, because otherwise, we'd be at full-scale war right now instead of having to kind of take it slow, getting reoriented here. How do they admit that actually Assad is the best thing Syria's got going? According to all the factions of Alawites, Shiites, Christians, Kurds, and even most Sunnis, or at least many Sunnis, a huge plurality, or I don't know exactly, a huge minority, at the least, of Sunnis also support the government because they don't want to live in Osama bin Laden-istan under these kooks. And so anyway, it seems like if that's the consensus in Syria, as tragic as that is, who the hell is America to continue to try to do that? Oh, that's right, agents of the Israelis and the Saudis. That's who America is. It's a big problem with empire. This is something that Justin Raimondo says all the time, is that, you know, domestic politics, as Gareth Porter agrees, domestic politics rules all when it comes to these sorts of foreign policies. And so the national interest isn't ever really carried out. It's always just whatever Tom, Dick, or Harry, whoever buys the senator the thickest steak wants, he gets. Squeaky wheel gets the grease. So we have a world empire where every interest on earth has an interest in bribing it. And we have a democracy, quote unquote, where you can buy it, all right. Come on in. Congressmen are a dime a dozen. Senators, two bits. Line up. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. All right, guys, well, I don't suppose I'm going to get this guy on the show, so I'm going to go ahead and talk about his article anyway. Howard J. Schatz from the RAND Corporation, which is owned by the Pentagon. But it's on the West Coast so that they're independent. And more thinky than tanky. You see? Anyway, yeah. They recommend horror shows. That's their job. They come up with excuses for the government to murder people. That's what the RAND Corporation is. Anyway, this guy is an economist type something or other, being counter sort of a dude there. And his name is Howard Schatz. And he's at Politico.com. That's S-H-A-T-Z. September 10th, 2014. To defeat the Islamic State, follow the money. And he says, hey, I've had access to some pretty good intelligence here. Some captured ledgers and, you know, paperwork and stuff that I and others have been studying. And here's what we learned. And what he learned is they're making a couple of million dollars a day. That's million with an M. They're expected to have a budget. And I swear, like, the entire spin here is that, oh my God, that's a lot, isn't it? Or something like that. And yet, no, they're expected to make $2 billion a year. No, the buffer didn't just skip out, and you didn't miss the part where I said $2 something something billion. Just, no, $2 billion per year. That is the expected annual revenue of the Islamic State. And he goes on to talk about their expenses. They got to pay everybody. If you have a family, they pay even more. If you get killed in battle, then they got to keep paying your family forever. That's, you know, their little bit of pension type health insurance sort of a promise that they've signed themselves up for and these other things. And man, it ain't easy being a caliphate, dude. And especially when there's not a single state anywhere on earth that will recognize this country ever or do business with them. They can only smuggle oil on the black market, which, you know, is somewhat lucrative, but only somewhat. Like, say, if you were smuggling oil and you were making $2 million a day, you'd be happy with that. Me too. Right. But you're not a self-proclaimed caliph of the no man's land between Iraq and Syria. So, in other words, these guys are a bunch of kooks with a bunch of American bought Toyotas that will rust. Oh, I don't know if they'll rust. They'll run out at like 300,000 miles. Maybe four. They're Toyotas, man. They're solid engineering goes into those things, man. You got to admit. So Barack Obama and John Kerry bought these guys a lot of Toyotas. They've seized a whole hell of a lot of Humvees and tanks and other equipment from the Americans. But, yeah, mostly all they have is light weapons. You know, as heavy, what caliber are those machine guns that they have in the back of those Toyota trucks? Those 50 caliber machine guns? The ones that shoot two? You know, maybe bigger than that. Anyway, still, that's still, you know, counts as the very lightest of armor, if it counts as light armor at all, right? These guys don't have a formidable army. Them selling you this enemy like they're 12 feet tall and all of this is just not true. I mean, you could compare them to the Taliban, maybe. But so that makes them a threat to, you know, women and girls within their jurisdiction. Doesn't make them a threat to the rest of mankind, as in all the propaganda. And the number one way to turn these guys this way is for America to be the ones to drive them out of power. After there are now more of them than ever before, to make America the responsible ones when it comes to all of the horrible things that are sure to befall them anyway, is the best way to guarantee that Americans die in this thing. That's, it seems like it's our government's policy to do exactly what these guys want time and again, over and over, to jeopardize national security by creating enemies for the American people. And, you know, it's just like people still ask to this day, what was the purpose of the Iraq War? Why did they do the Iraq War? Well, there's a lot of different reasons. And it's the same kind of thing here. A lot of different reasons. A big part of it, you know, I saw Hillary Mann Leverett, if you go to their Hillary and Flint Leverett's blog, Race for Iran. No, it's goingtotehran.com. You can see clips of her explaining that. When you come to D.C., everything that you're told is either by the political people or the national security state people. And what they all have to say is do more all the time. And so good luck being any human being when every bit of information, she says, the CIA and the Pentagon intelligence services were created to come up with reasons to justify power projection. Okay, it's built into their very structure more than any other bureaucracy, because it's deliberately built into their structure. Expand, expand, expand. Come up with reasons for expansion. You know, like Joe over there in the come up with reasons for expansion department with his 6,000 employees. However exactly it works is pretty much like that. And so that's a big part of it. And a big part of the reason that that is the way it is because there's just so much money in it. And more important than the money is the power. You know, the generals and the admirals, they have more say than the CEOs when it comes to this kind of thing. But boy, the CEOs really help. When a politician is listening to some generals and some admirals and their lackeys, and then he's looking over at his big money men and they're nodding their head, deal is sealed. Here we have Fortune magazine. The war on ISIS already has a winner. The defense industry. By which they mean the military-industrial complex. There's not much defense about it. We can all agree. Makers of munitions and unmanned aircraft to top the list of private sector beneficiaries. It's far too soon to tell how the American escalation and the sprawling complex mess unfolding in Iraq and Syria will play out. But this much is clear. As our military machine hums into higher gear, it will produce some winners in the defense industry. And anyway, he goes on. It's actually a very well-reported piece. I was hoping I could get him on the show, but I couldn't find an email for this guy. But he talks all about all the drones and the missiles. So Raytheon and then Northrop Grumman, of course, makes the Global Hawk, but it's General Atomics that makes the Predator. And now, who makes the Reaper? Is that the Reaper as well? Oh, as well as, yeah, the second generation Reaper, which can carry 3,000 pounds worth of bombs. And so you have all those guys are cashing in. And this is in Fortune magazine. This is for you to read on your yacht. One of the things that can help a new capability break through is an operational stressor, like a major air campaign. Oh, good. Yeah, now we're going to get all new mess of R&D money, too. Here comes unmanned drones small enough for the soldiers to throw in the air, including the Nano Hummingbird. And on and on. So if you don't mind burning in hell for life, invest in Raytheon and General Dynamics and Lockheed Martin right now. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, tonight, Angela Keaton and I are hosting a thing at liberty.me about war. That's all I know. No, I also know it's at 9 o'clock Eastern Time at liberty.me. I think it'll be on the front page of liberty.me. And it'll be like one of those things that Jeff Tucker does, only it'll be Angela and I. So that'll be cool. And after the show today, I'm going to talk to her, and we're going to decide what the hell we're going to do. But it's going to be about war, and it's going to be at liberty.me, and it's going to be at 9 o'clock Eastern, and that ought to be good enough for you, right? All right, cool. Yeah, see you there, then. And it's a chat room type of a situation thing, too, so you guys can participate. It'll be great. All right, yes, in the chat room, someone asked, well, what about Wall Street? Yeah, you know, well, it's kind of complicated. I mean, in general, American business, capitalism suffers when the government goes around making America and X brands that stand for America the bad guy in the world. Not only do they literally destroy wealth and a lot of, you know, property and whatever, but they destroy, you know, distribution systems and whatever with all their intervention. Generally speaking, we would all be making a hell of a lot more money. Lockheed and Raytheon and General Dynamics and their stockholders and executive vice presidents and so forth would be making less, but everybody else would be making a hell of a lot more. When it comes to Wall Street, you know, that can mean, you know, all the businesses listed on the exchange, or it can really mean the big banks that service all those biggest businesses. And when it comes to that, the banks tend to win, generally speaking, on wars, because government has to always go into debt to pay for wars. If they had to tell the American people, yep, we got to raise your taxes for this war, every time they wanted to have a war, you would see those polls say, hell no. Every time. Instantly. So instead, they just borrow it from China, borrow it from Japan, Korea, and of course, American investors and European investors, whoever is dumb enough to buy American debt right now. And then also they print the money and sell the debt to the Fed that prints the money, which is the giant bookkeeping trick that keeps the world enslaved. But anyway, so that's kind of the deal. That's what the Federal Reserve System really is it's a partnership between the banks and the government where they each promise to bail each other out. That's what it is. We'll buy your bonds if you will give us licenses to engage in fractional reserve banking and defraud our customers and engineer massive booms and busts. And so there you go. They work together to screw us all for their interests at the expense of the rest of us. Imagine that. Tends to be how it works over and over again. When you go back in history, you find bankers and their front men behind certainly the first two world wars, particularly the Morgan Bank in the First World War. But, you know, Murray Rothbard says, Which essay is this? Oh, it's Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy by Murray Rothbard. Have you guys ever read that? Man, you know what you guys ought to read? Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy by Murray Rothbard. It's like one long-ass essay, okay? You can do it. Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy. Man, it's the awesomest conspiracy theory history of the... Not even, just revisionist history of the 20th century. It's so good. And you know, he's no Bircher. He's the perfect libertarian. So there's not a bunch of, like, right-wing kookery in there. It's Murray Rothbard, the genius's genius, telling the story. And, oh, my point was going to be that what he says about World War II is, well, that was a compromise, see, between the Morgans and the Rockefellers. You get to have your war in Europe, and we get to have our war in Asia. And so, okay, there you go. And then, of course, by the end of the war, the Rockefellers were dominant and ruled the entire foreign policy establishment. Because, after all, the State Department, after World War II, was built on the structure of the Standard Oil Company's business relationships that they had already established throughout the world. Oh, you need State Department offices? No problem. We'll just give you, you know, a room at the local Standard Oil office that already exists everywhere in the world. So, you know, they were, and then of course the Council on Foreign Relations came up with all the staff for, you know, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and on. So, lots and lots and lots of Rockefeller power there in the second half of the 20th century. And anyway, so that, yeah, includes National City Bank, later Citigroup, and et cetera, and of course Chase, which is now J.P. Morgan Chase. All right, so, UK meeting. Oh, well, I guess I could talk about that. No, I kind of already mentioned it. Is it really important to mention? Everybody already knows this, or don't they? I should take this seriously and confront it and ridicule it. Because I saw on TV today, they wanted us to take seriously that John Kerry announces giant 14-nation coalition to take care of this problem. That is such a lie. As I was mentioning earlier, even the Brits aren't sending planes. Only the French are sending jets. And that's it. And as the Moon of Alabama blog put it, NATO tells America to go to hell. I think their words were worse than that. NATO tells America, oh yeah, we're going to help you. You know what we're going to do? We're going to, like, sit down and write up a piece of paper about how you could best deploy resources to Iraq. Like, what? Get out of here. Thanks a lot for being allies, you jerks. Just goes to show what a threat the Islamic State is to all of them, they think. But that's supposed to provide legitimacy in liberal minds. That's all that is. That's so that NPR News can say, oh yeah, look everybody, 14 nations, see? It's baby blue and multilateral and, yeah, no UN resolution or anything. It's not that baby blue, but just pretend, okay? Okay. That's for the liberals. The right wing doesn't care so much about that. Other than maybe, is anybody going to chip in any money at all, or it's all on the backs of the American people? Yeah. That question answers itself as asked, as you just heard. So, you know, I guess I want to talk about Somalia now. I want to talk about my failure to get somebody on the show to talk about this. It's some UN agency, but I don't care, man. I'll interview them about it. Reliefweb.int. Reliefweb.int. And they're citing here FuseNet, which is the Famine Early Warning Systems Network, which is, you know, hey, of all do-gooders, these guys are trying to be the best do-gooders of all. Hopefully not recommending too much intervention in local markets and destroying them, a la James Bovard's reporting, but alerting us to people in terrible food and water crises in the world. And again, this is at reliefweb.int, Somalia, humanitarian snapshot. As of 4 September 2014, the OCHA, over 1 million people in Somalia face acute food insecurity. This is a 20% increase from 857,000 people 6 months ago. This brings the number of people in need of humanitarian aid or livelihood support to over 3 million, according to new findings from the Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit and FuseNet. The worsening situation is due to a lethal mix of drought, surging food prices, increasing malnutrition, insecurity, and slow funding. And there they hit the nail on the head right there. It's the insecurity. It's the disruption in all of the markets and food distribution networks in Somalia because of the war that America has caused there. Oh, no, they're just peacekeeping troops, Scott. Yeah, anyway, so there's a war that's been going on over there that America's been paying for the last 13 years. And the people are starving to death still. And, I don't know. Isn't that objectionable or something? I'm pretty sure that it is. Yeah. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make the show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. You know, what are we doing about this anyway? I don't know. It's so obvious that I'm right and everybody who agrees with me is right, that the strategy, as proclaimed by Dear Leader, it just can't work. It makes no sense on the face of it. Anyone can look right at it and say it has all these different things built into it that make it guaranteed to backfire, to blow up right in our face. Here's a group that's weak that all we can do by intervening is strengthen them. That's all they want out of life, is for America to intervene over there. And, God dang, man, I don't know. I have these fantasies, I really do. Don't worry, this isn't going to be too disgusting. Just, I fantasize like if I had all this money, I would try to bankroll some kind of peace group, something that would combine the different peace groups and have very short, all-inclusive type statements by us, like, no, don't do this because it's horrible and wrong and it can't work and kill the people and waste the money. And I don't know, I guess I would need billions and billions. Billions and billions and billions. I need like a Bill Gates fortune. And just set up the new anti-imperialist league. If you vote the way AIPAC wants on anything, I will bankroll your opponents forever. Until you're gone. I guess that'd have to be our first position. We are the exact opposite of the Israel lobby, only we're Americans. And so, anything they say, we will spend double to try to stop it. How about that? And then, I don't know. Produce really well-done professional documentaries about every single warmonger on TV. And tell everything about them. All of their families and who pays them, Raytheon. There's a great new article, Mirko put it in the chat room here at The Nation, who's paying the pro-war pundits, and I hadn't had a chance to read it yet, but I saw Fran Townsend, Raytheon pays Fran Townsend to get up there and tell you stupid crap that couldn't possibly be true about why you need to pay her company to kill people. She's an official paid expert on CNN and Raytheon. And they don't mention that on CNN, but anyway. You know what I'd like to do? I would like to fly an SR-71 Blackbird and drop all the neocons and warmongers on ISIS. That'll teach them a lesson. I mean, I'd be going really, really fast at really, really high altitude. But then, boy, would I drop a lot of neocons and warmongers on ISIS. take that, you bastards, kind of thing. Anyway, but no, what I want to do is I want to spend money on a giant peace group. I want to somehow... and I would need magic as long as I have a magic $1 billion to create a magic $1 billion peace group. I would need a magic ability to keep all informants and agent provocateurs out. And we'd have to be single issue. Defund the Pentagon, bring the troops home, close the bases, abolish the empire. Immediately. Oh, and also hold a massive protest this weekend in every town. I mean, who's going to lead? The Answer Coalition, led by the Communist Party, they just dissolved when Obama was elected. Right? Like he was Dennis Kucinich or something. Obama, Hillary Clinton, only taller, got elected. And they said, oh, no need to be a peace group anymore. We're six wars later now. And who's holding the demonstration? Who's doing a thing about it? I don't know. I'm just complaining out loud. I'm sorry. I don't know what to do. I want to do something about it. I can sit here for 10 minutes, each 10-minute segment, and say, here's why this strategy can't work. Here's why it's all America's fault in the first place. Here's why it can only make things worse. And here's why we gotta not do it. And yet, no offense, but you and me, what are we doing? What can we do? I don't know. I mean, I'm the first to tell you that there ain't no democracy. But again, sort of like I talked about with the Ron Paul thing earlier. If 200 million Americans said, no, absolutely not. We will impeach you. We will have you impeached and removed from office the day after tomorrow if you do this. And we mean it. Then it just wouldn't happen. That's it. We will tear down D.C. brick by brick. How about that? But the American people just, oh, they cut off some guy's head, huh? Whatever. All right, you want to have a war? What do I care? That's the American people's answer. I guess so. Am I afraid? Let's see. The pollster asks me if I'm afraid. Honey, am I afraid? I guess, yeah, sure. The right answer is afraid and want war. Okay, yeah, I'm afraid. I saw on CNN this morning, again, I don't know if it's a new poll or what, 70% of Americans say that there are ISIS sleeper cells in America. What? But that's not what Obama says, and that's not what the FBI says, and that's not what the White House says, and that's not what the Counterterrorism Center says. And that's not even really what TV says. I mean, freaking Fox News has implied that, oh, the Mexicans are hiding ISIS for us or whatever. But I don't even think they've actually brought Frank Gaffney on the air, have they? And no one else is saying that's true. ISIS, 70% of the American people are of the opinion that ISIS has sleeper cells in America. 0% of them are in possession of any facts whatsoever that say that. But they don't care. Huh. The guy on the phone at the Gallup poll at the NBC, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post poll says, do I want the government to have a license to murder tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands more people over there in Mesopotamia? Yeah, okay. Yeah, go ahead. Thanks a lot, guys. And, you know, I mean, I hate opinion polls anyway, but it's just such a shame. Especially when we had, like, the Christmas miracle last August and September a year ago. When the American people said they didn't want a war with Syria. Now they want a war with Syria. And it's not like they really understood Obama wanted to back the Mujahideen against the secular, clean-shaven, chin-run state of Syria that wears a three-piece suit to work every day. They didn't really understand that. In fact, as I complained at the time, pointed out at the time, although I was willing to accept it, I guess, good enough, but really the answer was the American people don't care enough about the Syrians to bomb them all to death. That was the lesson of last year, was the Democrats blew it by spinning it as too much of a humanitarian mission. And the American people's attitude is, if the dictator of Syria wants to kill every last Syrian with chemical weapons, what do I care? And that was why they were anti-war. Only in the meanest son of a bitch kind of a way possible were they anti-war. And so in this case, they said, these ISIS guys want to hurt you. And then the answer to that is, well, then kill all of them. And I don't know. I stayed on the phone after the interview with Gareth Porter talking on and on the other day. And we made a bet for $10. I said, they're sending in the Marines. And he says, no. And he's Gareth Porter. I'd have shut up. But, you know, and I'm not even sure. I bet you the Army and the Marine Corps really don't want to do it. But then, you know, I just don't see a way out of it. They've talked themselves, they've painted themselves into this corner. ISIS, the Islamic State will be destroyed, they've said. So, you know, they can't let it go on too long. You're talking about a group with 15,000 fighters. If Baghdadi is still up there on the balcony gloating a year from now, it'll be an absolute disaster for the political people, you know? So, I think it won't be very long at all before, you know, they basically, just like CNN Girl this morning, like I said at the top of the show, CNN Girl this morning is already setting up the question. Geez, isn't it naive and irresponsible to rule out ground troops at this point? I mean, we just don't know how many ground troops we need yet, do we, expert former lieutenant colonel guest? You know? That's right, Susie. We might need to send the entire army again. Oh, okay. No. Just the entire SOCOM and JSOC and all the army that it takes to protect them and the medics and the armor and the air power. You know, to help the Iranians defeat ISIS.